This week on Writers, Inc.
I lie on the floor when I work, which most people think is really weird, but that's how I write.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I don't know if you guys can see this on camera. Can you see all the boxes and stuff like off behind
some
me
of
near
them,
my,
yeah.
my
a
fireplace?
Little, yeah.
Filling up your fireplace.
So you know how authors always say yes to everything?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I've got this book coming out. It's the prequel of my 4MK trilogy. So we're working with a ton of influencers to promote like the entire series. So I agreed to this early on, not thinking about the actual repercussions, but I agreed to send every influencer that works with me on this a box. And in that box, it's got the original trilogy, so three books, plus the new books, so now four books. Then it's got some little knickknacks and stuff that we're putting in there. Like we've got it, you know, the killer in the story cuts off, you know, people's, or he cuts out their eyeballs and he mails it to them, like all this stuff. So we've got a little white box that's got a candy eyeball in it tied with a black string. Some paper that has to go in there that has to be like collated and all this stuff. But there's 200 of them that I've got to put together. And I've got multiple people that work for me, but none of them are in the state of New Hampshire or anywhere yeah. near me where they could actually provide a hand.
Hear me out. Child labor. How old is your daughter?
Whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
I seriously considered that, like turning, you know, how do I turn this into a game for my daughter and her friends?
This sounds like a TaskRabbit thing.
That might be. I was looking at that too. Yeah. But I got to figure out like where in the house I'm even going to do this, because I've got, you know, I've done production stuff before, and like you basically, you know, in my mind, I've got to put all 200 boxes together. Then I go through, put like, you know, each book in there one at a time, then the next book, mm-hmm. then the next book. Yeah, like that's the yeah. fastest way to get it done.
Mm-hmm. You've got that fancy tent that you had last year. Go set that up on the lawn. Get some guys in there.
No, I can do it in that addition that we built. Like I've got enough room out there.
Yeah.
But I need to get going on it, because we're what, like 2 weeks into July already, and like mm-hmm. these things were supposed to be in the mail. So anyway, probably should not say yes to everything that, you know, every idea that crosses my desk.
That's
or my
good
mind.
Advice.
Yes.
That's that the good advice good for advice. Writers. Good advice for life. Don't say yes to anything.
But also that does sound very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. Yeah, I stumbled into something else too that I guess we can talk about. Like, I love working with influencers because they always think outside the box, kind of like I do, and they always want to, you know, do something just a little weird. But you know, I do a lot of television spots, and I think I mentioned this on the air before. Like, the highly produced stuff doesn't do as well as if I just take a TikTok video that some influencer recorded, you know, just talking about the book, blur the two sides so that it fits on a TV mm-hmm. screen, and just put that on the air. You know, which can be done for like next to nothing from a cost standpoint. Those work really, really well. Like, people just respond to them. Like, we see the click through when those ads run. Yeah. So word of mouth has gotten out that I'm doing this, you know, so influencers are like, well, if I record a video for J.D. Barker, he's going to put it on TV, you know, mm-hmm. like we have their handle on there. So it promotes their channel, you know, so it's a win-win for everybody. But like over the last week, I think I've had like 20 or 30 of these come in through my inbox,
nice.
You know, people that want to do it.
That's cool.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to draw a line at some point, because, you know, otherwise, like, I'm splitting up this budget between two, you know, so many different people yeah. that yeah. the commercials just aren't going to air enough to really impact anybody. So I got to pick yeah. like the best 10 or something. But yeah, it's a cool idea, and like it works great for everybody.
Well, I'm just happy we got one out there for our book. So I know yeah. that one went up. So it's
yeah,
like,
that
yes.
was like number two or number three. That was one cool. of the early ones. Cool. All right, what is going on in the news?
Well, first up, Facebook's effort to silence a critic is backfiring spectacularly. So this is on the good side of the news. A Meta legal effort to stop former executive Sarah Wynne Williams from promoting her memoir appears to have backfired through what's known as the Streisand effect, where trying to suppress information only draws more attention to it. During a popular podcast interview, Wynn Williams couldn't discuss her book because of a court order, so the host dramatically asked her to leave the studio before discussing the book without her. The clip went viral, reaching more than 8 million people. The publicity sent Careless People, that's the title of the book, soaring up the bestseller charts, jumping from number 625 to number 15 on Amazon in the US, while becoming the number one best-selling book in the UK for the week. I'm gonna start just shouting to the wind that don't pay any attention to my books. Don't pay any attention.
I think you have to have a little bit more going on and just like don't pay attention to this.
You need more going on.
A big company actively suppressing your book.
That's what I'm going to do.
The best publicity you can get.
Banned in 49 states.
Why don't you just stand outside Walmart with a big sign that says, "This store refuses to sell my book."
Oh,
I think that's a great idea. And there's a QR code.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's true anyway. Like they have not sold your book.
Yeah. I can make that claim for nearly every store. Just standing outside Target. Yeah.
How funny would that be?
Bass Pro Shop.
Yeah. Bucky's.
Oh my God.
You could do a whole series of every store that refuses to sell your book.
I'm totally going to do that now. So you guys have yourselves to blame.
That's pretty awesome.
That doesn't even sell books.
I think if you do one of those sandwich boards, you have to put one on Mini too.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do.
Absolutely.
Give her a little vest. This is a cool story. I don't really care about Meta and Facebook, but I do kind of like it when someone sticks it to them. That's just a favorite of mine.
They're very annoying on like their rules and kind of what they allow and what they don't allow. And you know, they always present it as like, it's this, you know, neutral thing and it's for the benefit of all, but like, then you always find some other decision that contradicts that. So,
yeah,
I get the feeling that the world is just slowly turning on social media. You know, like we all used it. Everybody was all gung ho about it. You know, now like I'm a parent, and like as a parent, like the last thing I want is my daughter on it. And like all of our friends are, you know, basically the same way. So like the generation that's had social media has kind of turned an eye, you know, like doesn't want any part of it anymore. And we don't want our kids to use it anymore. So it's like it's slowly taking on this just giant negative connotation. It makes me wonder, you know, like how far that's going to go. I mean, we've got countries outright banning it for 16 and under now. You know, so it's
I think when it started as like a connection, you know, it was supposed to like be sort of a way, you know, like Facebook kind of used to be like the album for like my family, right? Like that was kind of what it was for. And then it kind of grew and now you have influencers, which can be good, but then, you know, that also it can sometimes feel like, you know, the high school popularity contest all over again. And like that gets pretty tedious, like just to deal with constantly, I think.
Well, the idea of social media, I think, is fantastic. But it's when you pull the curtain back and you look at everything that they're doing with that data behind the scenes they're not telling us about. Yeah. Like that's what, you know, makes you feel icky.
Right.
And like what it's actually doing to people's brains. You know, like, you know, we're at a point where we've realized that. And, you know, it's almost like the junk food of the current century.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the whole series of stories about the Meta glasses and they found out that they were actually always on and some guy in Bangladesh is watching you poop or whatever?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a pair of those. You know, you guys, I think you've seen them. Like, and like we just went on vacation. We went up to Maine for a couple of days and like, I won't take them out of the house anymore. You know, like it was cool when they first came out and I, you know, messed around with it a little bit. Like it's fun on a roller coaster, but like people give you the dirtiest looks if you wear them in public and I don't want to be that guy.
No.
You know, so these sunglasses or whatever that cost a couple $100 are sitting in a box and they will probably live there forever until I throw them away.
I think people assume that my glasses are Meta glasses.
They probably are.
I think they
look very much like that.
They do look like that, but I just have a photographic memory, so I don't need no stinking Meta glasses. All right, the next story. Want to own your own library? Here's your shot. Two former Carnegie libraries are currently for sale in the U.S., giving book lovers the rare chance to own and live in a historic library building. The former library in Kendallville, built in 1913, is listed for $250,000 and still features many of its original library details after serving as a law office, a vintage clothing store, and an art gallery. A second former library in Nilai has already been converted into a private home and is listed for $369,000 while preserving much of its original architecture, including woodwork and curved entryways. Both of these are less than what my last house cost.
Right?
That's interesting. Yeah.
That is really interesting. What states are those in?
They were in Ohio. I looked it up. It was Ohio. Because, okay. I, you know, when we lived in Pennsylvania, we actually lived in Carnegie, Pennsylvania. Like, they pronounce it Carnegie there. If you pronounce it Carnegie, you get yelled at. So I thought, for like, this was there. My wife and I actually did this with a church when we lived in Pennsylvania. Like, we bought an old abandoned church and we turned it into a house and we sold it, as a house. You can do that with a lot of these old buildings. They're really cool. And, you know, like, anytime you have a construction project where you're not dealing with, you know, basic four walls where you've got odd, odd curves and tall ceilings or whatever, like, you can create a really cool environment.
Kara and I were going to do that with a firehouse where we got married.
Cool. Those kind of things are fantastic. If you can find them, and a lot of times you can pick them up on the cheap because they have to sell them as, what they are. They have to sell it as an abandoned firehouse, know, and like that's going to go for lower dollars than a, four bedroom, three bath.
Yeah.
So there, I was really looking forward to the fire pole. That was going to be awesome.
Don't
want to
know.
I can guarantee that that's out there somewhere. Somebody has already done it, and I'm sure they kept the fire pole.
All right, final story. Australia is publishing books too quickly, and everyone is losing out. Australian publishers are rushing books to market because of financial pressure, overloaded staff, and crowded release schedules, leading to editing mistakes and books being published before they're truly ready. Authors and editors say books often receive only about 3 months of publicity and bookstore visibility before they're replaced by newer releases, making it difficult for quality books to find readers through word of mouth. Smaller independent publishers are pushing back against the trend by publishing fewer books and spending years developing each title, believing that a slower, more careful approach leads to stronger books and longer lasting careers.
I thought this was interesting because this is something that I worry about with US publishing. With all the layoffs and all the loss of talent and everyone being overworked, could like books just be getting pushed through that aren't ready? I don't know.
Well, it's definitely happening. I'm hearing about it from people as they're getting published. Like, they're just going through the machine much faster than they did before. And I know, if I had to guess, like in the last year, I've probably seen three or four typos in new books, which is something you never saw before because they went through so many things. Like the print quality actually on a book that I just got, it was a number three New York Times bestseller. There were like four pages where like the printer ran out of ink, kind of look, and like that kind of stuff never slipped through quality control before. And now they just seem to be pushing them, through the machine as fast as they possibly can. I mean, I applaud the indie, publisher for taking a step back and realizing, like slow and steady does win the race. They can push ahead with quality.
Yeah.
This actually is kind of good news for indie authors, though, because, we've always gotten a bad rap for didn't spend enough time editing, didn't catch these mistakes or whatever. And we're the lowest of the low budgets usually. And so now people are starting to see this in the big publications. At the same time, a lot of indie publishers have figured out how to improve the quality of their work. So it's kind of nice. It's kind of, in a way, it's sort of like their failure is going to be our success, which is the best way to succeed.
Well, this is happening on a lot of different levels. To give you an example, this book cover that's behind me, that cost me a little shy of $2,000 to get done. The big publishers are not spending $2,000 on a book cover, unless it's their top authors, and they're dialing that back too. And it's not just the covers, it's the formatting, it's the copy edits, it's the number of edits that it's going through, it's the quality of the people that they're using to do those passes, all that stuff. They're looking, where can they save a dime? And like, that's where they're making the cuts. And indie authors, on the flip side, I think, are going in the opposite direction. Years back when Kindle first came out, absolutely, they created a cover in Microsoft Word, they threw it up there, they fixed the errors in the book later. But I think we've all learned our lesson. We're putting it through the paces before we're releasing those books. We're spending the money on the covers, it's one of those things where I think they're starting to pull ahead of the big guys.
More rounds of edit too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that the publishers like, Simon & Schuster and even Entangled, that are doing something different are going to be the ones that end up, bypassing and forcing the industry to like look at different approaches, like slowing down and actually doing things that work. So
Well, yeah,
I
a quick example, like in Kindle, if you're reading a book and you spot an error, you can report it. As an indie author, when I get those reports, I have that fixed, like within a couple of days, like it is done and a new edition is uploaded and that problem is gone. That doesn't happen on the traditional side. Like they may go in and fix the ebook. They're definitely not going to fix the print book. And if they do either of those things, it's probably 6 months after they hear about it or a year after they hear about it. It's whatever the next print run is going to be for that particular title. But indie authors, they're all over it.
The whole world's going indie. What can you say?
All right.
All right, that's it for the news.
Okay, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Daniel Silva coming back on. Dan's the number one New York Times bestselling author of 28 novels, and he's back with his latest thriller, Ransom. It's about the search for a missing wife of a British billionaire. It's number 26 in his long-running Gabriel Allon series. So here he is, Daniel Silva.
Well, welcome, Daniel. We're off to a shaky start because of technical glitches here, but I'm glad you stuck it out with me.
No, there's no such thing as a shaky start on a podcast.
People need to hear that we flub these things every now and then so that they have confidence in what they do. So you and I were just chatting. Sorry you have to say it all again.
It's fine.
but this is we're talking about the 26th novel in your Gabriel Allon series, Ransom, which I am enjoying. I only got it a few days ago, so I haven't been able to fully read it yet. But 26 books is a lot for one series, man. Even I don't have that yet. That's impressive.
It's I well he was only supposed to appear in one book, so it goes without saying that he didn't expect to write 26 books. But so even after I committed to the series, I still didn't think that I would get to 26. And I think that what I've done over the course of the series to make sure that I stay interested and the readers stay interested, I keep changing it up. There are definite little sub blocks of the series, and where we are now is where I always thought that it was going to end up. And Gabriel, he lives mainly in Venice, where he is a very prominent art restorer and lives under his own name. Works for his wife, basically. His wife is the director of a very prominent restoration company in Venice. And then I just for laughs, I gave him a nice summer cottage in Cornwall to hang out in. And that's where we find him at the beginning of this book.
Now, well, you've spent time in Cornwall. Is
Oh,
that
yeah.
clearly you're drawn to
It's a
it?
magical, it's just Arthurian magical place. And I actually wrote a big hunk of the first Allon book there. I was doing some research in the London art world, met a bunch of people there in the restoration community and in the art world. Got in my car, drove out to lock myself in a cottage in Cornwall and started writing. And so Cornwall has played a big role in Gabriel's life and in mine as well, because that's where I created him.
It's interesting that you, because you've looped in somehow the art world and this world of like espionage, special forces, all these highly trained people. And the art world always seems to attract that kind of thing. But tell me how the pieces fit. How did this all come together?
Well, it fit in that the art world provided Gabriel with his cover, and initially, and I tell you, when I those weeks that I spent in Cornwall, it just took over that first book, and I was able to write about these characters in a way that I had not written about any other characters. So I know we're talking about the craft of writing, but the character himself or herself for me, sort of determines the voice and the way you write. And so one of my favorite points of view within the series has always been the point of view of this eccentric art dealer in London named Julian Isherwood. And Julian was basically recruited to help provide Gabriel his cover. And he has the most magnificent point of view. It's self-deprecating, it's erudite, it's charming, it's witty. And so he's always been a sort of an important voice within the series. And then the characters around Julian have just grown in prominence over the years. And so the London art world and that madcap menagerie, as I describe them, of characters there are a really important component to the series. And they you know, look, yes, Gabriel, you know, was a intelligence officer. And yes, these were spy novels, but they were written in a completely different way than most spy novels. Right. And as a result, I appeal to readers who generally don't read spy novels. And so now I've, you know, Gabriel is he's a man of many talents, and I can, he's very versatile. I can sort of put him in any kind of story I want now. He's a great art investigator, art crime investigator. He does a good job investigating murders. And in this case, he acts as a kidnap and ransom specialist to try to get a kidnapped woman back.
Yeah, he's the multi-tool of literature.
Yeah, exactly. So
you don't get this many books, especially as many that you as you have that have hit the New York Times list, without a character who can capture the audience. How are you? What do you think it is about Gabriel that makes him so sticky with the reader?
Well, first of all, he is very unique. The fact that he is an art restorer is obviously the primary appeal of him. I think it's fair to say that. And the fact that restoration, the concept of restoration, is the central theme of the whole series and of every book. You know, if Gabriel were to come in my office and he'd see a book that's not straight, he would fix it. He's just one of those guys, and that's what motivates him. But he also has a tragic backstory of his own. He's a man of violence when he needs to be, although I have really started to phase that out of his character. He is charming, he's elegant, he's witty, he's well-read, he's erudite. He is just a very, very sophisticated and likable character.
What's made you decide to start phasing out the violence?
Because I was always pushed to put more violence in the books than I ever wanted to in all my books. As I've said this many times before, I'm sort of a literary novelist masquerading as a thriller writer. And I remember when I wrote my first manuscript, an editor said, you gotta have more higher body counts and all these things. And I was pushed to make him, you know, there were characters that were succeeding in the marketplace at the time that were, you know, really did good guys who did bad things. My editors and publishers sort of wanted to make sure that, you know, Gabriel, there were two sides of his character, the good side, and that when he needed to do bad things and be violent, he did it. And I guess that a part of me wishes I had stuck to my guns a little bit and not made him quite so willing to reach for the gun when necessary. But it's easy to second guess at the, you know, at the end of a career. But he's had a very good run. But I like the way he is now, and I like the way I'm writing now. The books are a little bit more mystery and rely less on physicality.
It's almost, though, I would think that that's a little bit of fiction mirroring life in a way, because he had to be violent because situations forced him to. Same with you. You were forced to, quote unquote, be violent.
I wasn't forced to, but they really, like, they,
yeah. I was trying to give you an out here, Daniel.
Wasn't forced to, but I, I mean, if you read the, when I created him, it's just very interesting to go back and read what I wrote about him and the things that were coming out of his mouth about, you know, things like targeted killing. Okay. Yeah, he's saying it that doesn't work. We shouldn't be doing this. I don't want to do it anymore. It doesn't work. We just kill this person and the next guy comes along and he's even more hardcore than his predecessor. And I'm just not interested in doing this work anymore. And he only got drawn into it in the first place because he sort of fit a profile. You know, I wrote about Gabriel that you know, he is Israeli by birth, but he's raised in a German-speaking home. It's his first language. It's still the language of his dreams. And they needed someone who could blend in like that. And he was the right man for the right job.
Yeah. So one of the things that's really interesting about this series and all your books is the cast of characters, the supporting characters, as they were.
Yeah.
So how important are they? Well, actually, what I really want to ask is there ever a moment where one of those supporting characters threatens to take over the book and become the main character?
Well, I mean, if you look at some of the books where I've handed off key things to them, so yeah, they become as Gabriel rose in prominence, you know, he became more of an operational chief. He would always have to come in at the end, but so yeah, I would hand off to other characters and write from their point of view and let them. The character of Natalie Mizrahi in The Black Widow. Yeah. Gosh, she's on the page for 150 pages at least from her point of view, and it's very special. And so I like to. It gives me an interesting break as well. So I make sure that the sort of like a rib cage. Like he's the sternum, and they branch off, but he's always. Must be the spine of the story.
He's the sternum and the spine.
He's the sternum and the spine.
That guy's the middle of everything.
What That's a right.
Macabre way to put it.
Yeah.
perfect. It's perfect. Let's talk now then about the book itself, Ransom. You've got everything in this book. You got billionaires. You got, you know, people with secrets. let's give the rundown for people about what the book actually is about.
Okay.
We'll talk about
well, it is number 26, as we said before.
Yeah.
When it opens, we find Gabriel in Cornwall, who's hoping to spend a quiet summer with his family, but he agrees to be the star attraction at a fundraiser for the National Gallery of Art. And one thing leads to another, and the host of that event, a billionaire property baron named Edward Knight, shows up at Gabriel's door in Cornwall a few days later and asks him to track down his wife, who has disappeared without a trace. His wife is this dazzling, beautiful younger wife named Alice Winter. Dazzling socialite, big social media profile. And she has disappeared while on holiday with four old friends in Ibiza. And Gabriel agrees to try to track her down. And in the process, discovers that Alice has a very dangerous secret, a secret that will force Gabriel to return to a life that he thought he had left behind. So it is part kidnap drama. It's part international thriller. It's very fast paced. It's very readable and entertaining, I think. But like all my books, it deals with a contemporary serious issue. And in this case, it is Russia. You know, we all know that Russia is at war with Ukraine, but Russia is also engaged in a secret war of sabotage and subversion against all of the countries in Western Europe right now. And they are blowing up pipelines. They are hacking big businesses, and they're carrying out assassinations. They are targeting transportation. And one of the things that they are doing is they are using drones. Drones and the emerging threat of drones plays a big role in this book.
How tough is it for you to stay ahead when you're writing? If you're going to write about Russia, those guys are going to come up with stuff that, you know, would make a novelist's head spin. How do you make sure you're kind of staying ahead of the curve there?
You know what? I make sure that I know everything there is to know that's available publicly. And then I talk to my sources in the intelligence business and get their read. And then I take the liberties that I need to take to make the story work. But I do sort of name names in this book. You know, most Americans, I mean, let's face it, most Americans don't read newspapers anymore. So most Americans don't realize that Russia is truly, truly at war with these countries right now. It's secret. It's hybrid wars, as the Russians call it. But if you were to ask the Danish prime minister whether she thinks that she's at war secretly with Russia right now, the answer is yes. So I just do the best I can on my research. And then I make sure that I give myself the freedom to do what's necessary so that I can end the book the way I did this book. And I know you're not there yet, so I don't want to spoil it for you or for our listening audience, but it's got one of my better endings, and it's got a huge twist at the very, very end on the last page of the book. The advanced reads on this one have been great. I'm very proud of it.
How do you handle research? What's your methodology?
I do it very carefully. And you know, you got to be careful about what gets floating around out there. And so I used only quality sources for my my research. I don't know if you can see my background is blurred, but this is one of my libraries. There's another whole shelf here. I'm either writing a book or reading a book all day long. Yeah. I just do a tremendous amount of research. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, do you like keep notebooks? Do you just absorb?
I absorb and I have a semi-photographic memory. So it's very easy for me to, unless it's a cheap version of something, I don't mark up my books that I'm using. I like to keep them clean. I'm a little fastidious about that. So I'll flag things like that. But I'll keep a Word file of important notions that I want to get in. But I don't have, you know, vast notebooks filled with scribblings about research. You don't need that anymore. I keep a subfile inside my file. And I'm just throwing stuff in there. But they, as I said, they come from quality sources and not the junk that's out there.
I call that my ash bin. I've got like this little file that's just where I dump everything, and I can sift through there later if I want to.
So it's a catch-all for everything or for a specific book that you're working on?
For a specific book. I do it
okay,
per
yeah.
book.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, if you could see my Finder, you'd see the all the chapters, and then there's a folder there that says research, and I it's easy to take a piece from the New York Times, turn it into a PDF, and fire it in there.
Right,
that's what I do.
Yeah, do you? What's your writing tool of choice? You write in Word, you said?
I write Word, but I write in longhand. I lie on the floor when I work, which most people think is really weird, but that's how I write. I don't know if you, it's probably blocked, but there's a little desk lamp on the floor over there.
Okay.
And I'd lay there and write, and then I'll reach critical mass and then come over here and take that stuff that's written in longhand, type it into a Word file, and usually make a transition to original composition at the keyboard. But I start the day on the floor, nice
Yeah,
and quiet,
that's
nice and quiet.
interesting.
Yeah,
Yeah,
nice
what
and
started
quiet.
that? Why did you do that?
I always write in longhand. I like to
Yeah, but why on the floor?
even when I was a journalist, even when I was a journalist, if I'm trying to get a lead write or something, I always take out a pen and pencil or scribble it out in longhand first. I don't
Yeah.
know why, but for me, that's I know that Ann Tyler, I don't know if she still does it, but she used to take her finished typescripts and then rewrite the whole book out in longhand.
Interesting.
Why? Because excuse me, it helped expose, false notes and stuff that she didn't like. Jamie and my wife and I re we read it aloud, and so reading aloud is really, I think my books are sort of written for the ear more than the eye, anyway.
You know, that was always the advice I was given growing up. I never do it. And maybe I should, but that was always advice I heard given to writers is that you should read the manuscript out loud when you're
I
doing like
do.
your rewrites and edits. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I have to know why the floor though.
Don't know. Look,
Just comfortable there, huh? Yeah.
Google Muriel Spark, okay, the
Okay.
British novelist. The first, I'm sure the first photograph that will come up, you'll see her lying on the floor with her manuscript, this iconic
Okay.
photograph of her.
Okay.
And that's it. I mean, if you see which is the only thing that I have in common is Woody Allen,
Yeah.
but he got he, you see these videos of him lying in a bed with a yellow legal pad, and that's how he's writing his
Right.
screenplays. He's not
Right.
sitting at a desk doing
Yeah. Hey,
it.
Trumbo wrote in a bathtub. So.
Yeah, that's love. I love the birthday party scene in the movie,
Was
when
great.
they, yeah,
Yeah.
what do you mean, get out of here? I live in perpetual servitude. He also popped Benny's and drank whiskey all day.
He
I don't, I
did,
don't.
and I've got half that going for me. I'll let you guess which one. So before we started chatting, and actually when in the lost part of the episode that didn't get recorded, you were talking about how you actually release on the same day every year. You have a book ready by the same day every year. So, and that's to appease the publisher, or is that like
No,
what
but
was your choice there?
it's well, I fell onto this date because we had to renovate a house,
Okay.
and I tried to write in the rental house. It wasn't working.
Yeah.
I live here in Washington. Georgetown University is right there. If I'd go to the library every day and try to write in the library, it wasn't working. I just kept falling farther and farther behind on my book, and so we just shifted me from my usual spring publication date to July. It's a book called The Messenger,
Yeah.
and I just missed being number one on the New York Times list. I hadn't achieved that yet, so we stayed there, and so I've been on that second Tuesday of July ever since, and it just works for me, and that's my date.
Yeah.
And but if you look at the calendar, you'll see that John Sanford is publishes on his day, and
Yeah.
we're all sort of on a checkerboard.
Right. Right.
It just works. The industry, the bookstores know when to expect you, and
I think it's a great idea. I should do something like that, but
but it does force me to work a little faster than I would prefer. I mean, the one thing I had to do is teach myself or train myself or figure out a way that I could effectively write a book in like 5 months. I don't have a full year to write a book with all the promotion responsibilities and things like that. So, I the writing year is I have to finish a book by April 1st. Very tight at the end. That means I have to finish a book by about March 1st. Mm-hmm. And so September to March 1st, September, you know, from Labor Day to March 1st is the effective writing year. It's pretty short.
Yeah.
It's pretty short. And I had to devise a way to do it and to keep the quality up. It basically means work all day, every day.
Yeah, work all day, every day. I was actually going to ask you, like, how long between finishing one and starting the next? So it sounds like you finish in March and you start in September. So you
no, I finish a what I euphemistically refer to as a first draft.
I see.
On March 1st, that's the goal. I actually have a TypeScript here of Ransom. So this is when it started out, it was significantly fatter than that. And then, so we sit, my wife and I sit, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks and just read. And it's basically a process of you know, taking the very, very best from what I've written. I consider that first draft not necessarily a true first draft. It's just long detailed outline. And then it's chiseling that into a first draft. So 95% of this is exactly what I wrote in the first go around. And it's that 5 to 10% new stuff that gets it over the edge. And so Jamie and I sit and read it aloud, go through it, you know, chapter by chapter. She ruthlessly cuts out things. I ruthlessly cut out. It's much easier to cut at the end than when you're writing. I mean, you're not, okay, you know, and cut and recraft things. There's some new material that goes into it usually. So then by April 1st, then I hand in. And I get 2 weeks to do one more TypeScript. April 15th, I hand in. And then it's the production process. So by the last week of May, it's done. It's got to be. That's how quickly we can get it printed in the bookstore. So they're pretty good at it. The only way that I can stop fiddling with it is to start something right away.
Yeah.
So I get to work. I always the next book always settles as I'm working on it, finishing another book when I sort of get into clear air. So I just need to forget about it. And I get, you know, if it's going well, I get so deep in the new one that I sort of have to refresh my memory to get ready for book tour.
Do you have to reread? Do you have to go back and look at your old books?
I try. I mean, it's 26 now. It's safe to assume that a lot of my readers know the series better than I do. So I don't have to reread, but it does help me every once in a while to go back and look at the way I did something.
I mean, do you keep like a note or something, you know, a wiki or something because that's a lot of characterization to remember, you know?
I don't write anything down. I don't write in any notes or outline or anything like that. And so usually when I get to a spot where, you know, the book is sort of in hand and I know exactly what I will sit down with my wife and tell her. It's sort of, we call it the in case I die conversation, that maybe someone could have a go at finishing a book for me. So I'll say it out loud, but it's just, I don't have enough time to sit and waste time to, you know, writing down what I'm going to write. I just keep it up here.
Yeah.
Which is scary. I mean, I live with it in my head for, you know, these many months. And that's the way I do it. I don't have time. I mean, you know, I read this article once about, you know, Lee Child and another writer were talking about whether to outline a book or not. Mm-hmm. And Lee Child, you know, didn't have anything against it, but he's like, I don't have time, you know. He's on a very similar schedule. I don't have time. He's a professional, experienced professional, knows what he's doing. And he gets to work, and that's how I feel.
Well,
and I have to be honest with you. I think that most of the men and women who you think are you know really good at their craft, they don't outline. Agatha Christie, for example, right. Very detailed outline, very very yeah. detailed. But a lot of people don't outline, and I'm one of them.
I know. It's the ongoing. I wouldn't call it a debate or controversy or anything, but it is interesting to talk to so many authors and see there's a definite split. There's a you know there it, there it's pretty equal. The number of authors who you know pants the book and the number who plot it. That's writing for you.
I guess I go forward if I'm going to make a change. If I get to page, you know, 80 and I'm okay, we're going to go to, I go back and I make the adjustments. Yeah. Sort of like a painter who puts obliterating yeah. paint over something and repaints it. So it's buried under the layer of paint, but I've just painted yeah. over it. Well, and that's the way I do it.
What an appropriate way to round off the interview. Talking about painters. The new book, Ransom. When do you, I failed to jot down the release date. What's the release date? It's every day the same year.
Well, it's
every year the same date.
The same Tuesday. I think it's the 14th this year, right?
Yeah.
I should know that.
We'll get it right when we're talking about it. But thank you so much for hopping in with me. And it's good to see you again.
It's nice to see you.
Always excited to chat with you. I always love reading your stuff. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
So I love talking to Daniel, by the way. I think this is like the third or fourth conversation I've had with him. So I did not do the standard thing where I'm like, how'd you get your start or any of that? But he had a lot of insight that I think is useful to authors, especially when it came to like his characters. And he was talking about how Gabriel Alon was a character that started as it was just supposed to be temporary. It's like a one book, one off character, but he's evolved over like 26 novels. So how do you think writers can build a character that's flexible enough to sustain a long series like that without losing the core, the thing that readers fell in love with?
I think it's tough, you know, especially because he kind of fell into the same trap a lot of other authors, you know, do or did. You know, he put the first book out there. His publisher said, well, you know, these books are doing really well. Their heroes do this, this, and that. You need to do this, this, and that, too. You know, so all of a sudden your character's carrying a gun and you may not want them to carry a gun. And now you're stuck carrying a gun for the next 28 books, you know, so, but you know, you take somebody like, no, we'll pick on Dan Brown, you know, like Robert Langdon hates guns, you know, cause Dan hates guns. And I doubt you'll ever see Robert Langdon have a gun. And you're like, that was a conscious decision from the get go. And he's followed through on each book so far with that kind of thing. You know, it's, but you get so many voices in your head, I think, telling you what to do, especially when you're new at it. And you tend to listen to them because you just don't know any better. You just assume this editor knows more than you do.
Yeah.
I think making a character as real as possible. And what I mean by that is, like, if you think about people, like, we are very nuanced and flawed, and there's like a lot of layers to us. And so I think that, like, the more time you kind of spend, you don't have to have all that figured out, but you know, the more time you spend kind of getting to know your character on like that really deep level, like I think that you'll kind of discover new layers that can be mined in future books that still feel very authentic to the character. You just have to make sure that it's consistent, that it feels like it belongs to them. And I think readers are happy.
As an author, I think it makes a lot of sense to go back and read book one in a, you know, long writing series like this, just to figure out how much they did establish from the get go. You know, because if you read like the very first Jack Reacher novel, he laid it all out. You know, in that very first book, he knew who Reacher was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't say Reacher's name until like page 15, which I think is kind of cool. But you know, as far as the character traits and everything else, they're there.
Do you see your characters drifting over the course of a series?
You know, like changing as people or
drifting off book basically.
Not so much anymore. It definitely happened in like when I was writing Fourth Monkey. But I tend to go back, like once I dial in whatever that personality is, I go back through the book and then just make sure it's consistent all the way through the book. And when I'm writing something within a series, I always read the previous books in that series before I start the new one, which kind of gets my brain in the right, you know, mindset. I think if I took too much time in between and I stepped away and I wrote, because I write a lot of books, and if I were to, take 4 or 5 years off and not do that, I might end up with a very different character.
Yeah. I have like my primary protagonists over the various series are pretty dialed in. So it's kind of, I know how they think and how they're going to react to things. So even if their life circumstances change from over the course of the series, I know what their core is. So, Dan Cotler is always going to be kind of, a little bit of a wise ass, but he's, dry wit, very intelligent, very observant, that sort of thing, smarter than I am. So as long as I can continue playing him smarter than I am, he's going to be Dan Cotler. Yeah. It's not hard to do.
I was thinking about, it's interesting that he was like, oh, I had to kill more people in my books because that's what my editor told me to do. And now he's getting less away from that. And then I got thinking about like, how many people do you need to kill in a thriller? Is it boring if you kill nobody? What do you think?
I think it's better to go the opposite direction if you can. I mean, if you have, like, killing them is kind of the easy way out, sometimes if you've got a bad guy in front of you. So if you refuse to kill the bad guy, that makes it tougher to write, but it's a better scene.
Yeah.
I think it's always just about, it has to feel like real to the story, real to the character, and then interesting for the reader. So, like JD said, if killing him is kind of the easy way out, and then you can kind of think like, well, what else can I do? And how else can I do this? And, I think I've read thrillers that don't necessarily have, like, psychological thrillers are a lot like that. Like, nobody necessarily dies, but the stakes feel incredibly high. And like, you're constantly wondering what's going to happen and what does this mean? Yeah.
You called that out on the book I had you read from me, the Hollow King. You did. You're like, nobody died. One person did die, by the way.
One person did die. Yeah. I didn't say it as a bad thing.
You need at least 10 people. You have to kill at least 10 people.
Gotta have at least 10 people.
I don't think it was a bad comment. I think I was just surprised that it was a very specific.
I didn't take it as bad. It did make me think for a minute, like, oh, I wonder if this is a boring story because I didn't kill a bunch of people.
No, I thought it was interesting. Like, sometimes it is interesting. You get to the end of something and you realize, oh, no one died.
If you want to check out a really cool example of this, read Greg Hurwitz's latest Orphan X book.
Yeah.
Because the entire series is about a trained killer. The guy was raised from little kid to being a killer. But the latest book, the girl that he's defending basically tells him, you're not allowed to kill anybody.
Oh, that's cool.
So he's got to go through the whole book, doing anything other than kill the people that he would normally just wipe off the map and move on and, go have lunch.
Yeah, because I've read a couple of those books at least, because we've had Greg on and lots of people die. So that would be an interesting
way to his default mode of operation. So if all of a sudden he's not allowed to do that, it makes it kind of fun.
Nice.
It's like if John Wick, if you said, look, if you kill anyone, this little girl dies.
Mm-hmm.
John Wick would break a lot of
break
bones.
Every bone in their body. They'd be alive.
A lot of bones would break.
They'd be in traction for the rest of their lives, but they are alive.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think that's enough. I think that's we've discussed Mr. Silva's book. I got one more question if we want to tackle it.
Why would you ever write on the floor was my question.
I know. I was so curious and he kind of glossed over it, but I think it's a comfort thing.
I'm not going to reveal his age, but he's not a young man. I'm just like.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I don't think I could get back up again if I was writing on the floor. Like, I do everything on the floor now.
I've got a very comfy chair. I like my comfy chair.
Look, I've had to shift the way I do things so often over the past couple of years and just the past like 5 months. I've worked out of laundry rooms, at kitchen counters, at patio tables, and I've never had the same chair twice as far as I can tell. So I have gotten used to just improvising wherever I am and being comfortable.
But not the floor.
But I have yet to sit on the floor to write.
Just see.
So far, do you guys have like a weird, anything quirky about your writing setup or scenario?
I have a very comfortable chair. Sometimes I'll write
No.
it like different
Fine,
tables and
Christine.
stuff,
What's
but
the weird thing you do, though? Is there something you do that's
yeah.
weird? No.
I don't know if it's weird, but like, I mean, I definitely like being comfortable. So, I mean, I will write from bed, I'll write on the couch, I'll write wherever I can create a nice little cocoon. I like cocoons, is what I've
Okay.
decided. I like being comfy and cozy and kind of, just being able to sort of like melt into the writing.
So let me ask you a question. Can you take this too far? Like, can you get too comfy where you don't get anything done? Because, like, that's what would happen to me. If I tried to write in bed, like, I'd probably just fall asleep. I wouldn't get any words done.
Surprisingly, I mean, like, if I'm really tired, obviously, like, I will start to feel like drowsy, but I would feel that if I'm that tired, I would feel that at my desk too.
Yeah.
So, I have, you learn, I think, when you kind of do the cozy, like, I've learned how to figure out, like, so I guess I'm very moody. I know, big shocker, but so I follow my mood. If I'm kind of feeling
Yeah.
like very like upbeat and productive, like I like to be at my desk and in my office and it's nice and it's bright. But if I'm sort of like cranky or like, just don't kind of feel run down, then I like to cocoon. And I find if I follow my mood, then I actually end up being more productive than if I tried to fight my mood.
That's
I don't know
smart.
if that makes sense.
That makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
Makes me realize I do not want moods. They sound like a
Oh,
major hindrance to the process.
moods aren't terrible. You just have to learn how to like recognize like, okay, like what's going on here, but
I'm pretty good about getting past the mood. I most mornings these days I face existential dread until I force myself to get past it. I scream at my laptop until I'm comfortable, and then I write.
but that's the trick, is not fighting it or like getting over it. It's just being like, all right, it's like acceptance. It's like the ultimate acceptance. Like, all right, here's my mood. What do I have to do to get into, what do I have to do to make this work for me instead of against me? And so I guess like sort of I gamify it a little bit that way. And so that's why I've kind of learned like how to identify kind of like what's going to help me do what I need to do that day. And then I just
Yeah.
do it.
Very cool. All right. On that note, JD, who's up next week?
Next week we've got Stig Abell coming on. Stig's a British journalist, broadcaster, and author. He's the co-host of the Times Radio Breakthrough Show, and previously worked at for BBC Radio. His latest novel is called A Twist in the River. It's book four in his Jake Jackson series, and it released, I believe, earlier this year. I think it was March. So Stig Abell.
Sounds good. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.